Thank you for the special music. It was wonderful to hear, not just at church services, but we're getting back to live music in other places. It's a real blessing to have. There's a lot of instruments in the world. Nobody knows better than I am, sitting in closets unplayed. And Alan gets to get out from time to time. And I plan to do everything I can to help that process along. We'll be spending a lot of time in the book of Job today, if you want to turn there. It's nice to see all of you. I see the rebars and the housings down front. And again, it's good to see everybody. It looks like everybody is wearing subdued clothing, though. A lot of blacks and grays. I assume you're all mourning the end of daylight savings time, as I am. But it's not, there is some color. Vicky's got color. I see Jan has some purple on, and Lois has nice autumn color. So good to see you all. Job is the coolest book in the entire Bible, and possibly also the strangest. I mean, look at the beginning alone. There was once a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That's the Bible equivalent of long ago in a galaxy far away. And there's no other book that starts quite like that. It's an ancient tale. We don't know when it was written down, but the tale has been told for thousands of years. It even appears in other cultures, in Egypt, in Akkadia, in Sumeria, not exactly the same, but the tale is there of a man in the East who went through a great deal of suffering. We don't know when it was written, and we don't know by whom. We know it wasn't written by Job because, you know, he's not around for those beginning chapters, and he dies right before the end. It seems to be completely outside the context of history. We can't place it, and also oddly outside the context of Israel. Job is not an Israelite. That's a wonderful thing. It shows that even back then, God was interested in the whole world, his entire creation. But also it gives a universality to the tale. It makes it apply to all of us. Was he real? Some people say that this book reads like a thought experiment where a problem is set up and then people discuss it and then it gets solved. Well, Ezekiel says it was real. In Ezekiel 14, scripture you're probably familiar with, Ezekiel's talking about something completely else, but twice he mentions, he's talking about the sins of Jerusalem. And he said, even if there were people as righteous as Noah and Job and Daniel in your city, the city would still get destroyed. They would only save themselves. And he says it twice. So Ezekiel treats Job as a real person. And of course, Daniel was a contemporary of Ezekiel. So he was quite convinced he was talking about real people. Job is also mentioned in the book of James. In James 5:11, James is talking about suffering and people enduring things. And he talks about what's often called the patience of Job. And that's a bit of a misunderstanding because the word that James uses, and it's translated that way in a number of cases, is the endurance of Job, the persistence of Job. And that's what he's being praised for. And that's what James is trying to encourage his brethren in the first century to do. The world thinks and understands the book of Job. It's a fable. It's a parable. Everyone basically knows the plot. I remember we studied it in 11th grade at Brush High School, where I went with Bruce Lesko. We studied the play J.B. by Archibald MacLeish, which was based on the book of Job. And next to it, we studied the actual book of Job. I don't know how many of us read the entire book, but it was presented and the world knows it. People think it's a simple story that questions, why do good people suffer? Let them think that if they want to. It can be read at that level. It just never gets around to answering the question, does it? If you read it, and I'm going to assume that all of you have read it, and if you haven't read it, well, get busy, because it's a story that you need to know, particularly now. And I hope when I say that it really doesn't answer the question, why do good people suffer, that I'm not undermining the December Bible study. But I offer you the possibility that it's about not just more things than that, but about more important things than that. And is a book very much for us today, especially in the face of all the things that we're facing. I could talk for hours about the book of Job, but let's not. I'm going to take as a given, as I said, that you've read it and that you know the general story. But let's grab our Bibles and just do a brief overview of the book so we know the outline of what we're talking about. At the very beginning, the first two chapters are a prologue. There was once a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. The man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. And from the beginning of the book to the end of the book and beyond, according to Ezekiel and James, that's never questioned. It talks about his riches. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and very many servants. And he was the greatest of all the people in the East. We're not sure where the East is in this case. It seems like it could be the land of Edom. There, you'll see on your maps in back of Bibles the word Idumea, which is southeast of Judea, and that's just another word for the land of Edom. We really can't place it. Job's friends are said to come from certain places, and it seems like that those places would be in the land of Edom and certainly in the Near East, not that far away, but a different land entirely. It's interesting that in the 25th chapter of Genesis, it talks about Abraham's children. And you're used to Abraham having Isaac and one other son whom he sent away. But with his wife Keturah, Abraham had 6 other children. He had a total of 8 children. So the land is full of, the globe is full today of the descendants of Abraham. You know, when an ancestor is that far back, there's so much intertwining in it. It would involve possibly even billions of people. But at the end of that section in Genesis 25, he talks about the children of Keturah, and he keeps them separate by sending them to the east, to a land to the east. And it's thought that these people might have come from them, so that they could be descendants of Abraham, but they're not Israelites. Israel isn't a term that comes up in the entire book. Back to the text. Talks about his sons used to go and hold feasts in one another's houses in turn, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the feast days had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings for all his children, because he said they might have sinned. And that's the way Job operated. It talks about then a day when the heavenly beings gather before God. This is most unusual because there's no humans to observe it. There's no narrator who knows that this happened. Job never found out that it happened. And it's possible for the entire book, possibly for his entire life. He never knew about this court. God never brings it up. And it's possible that Job's own view of the situation is colored by not knowing this. Or God may have told him, or may have told him later. When human beings did find out about it, and someone either found out enough about it to write this book, or else figured it out and wrote it, the information must have come from a heavenly being. There was a being among them called the Accuser. It's not his name. It says S-A-T-A-N, but it's Ha-Satan, and it means the Accuser. It's an odd word. It can apply to human beings and does apply to human beings in the Bible. And in one very strange situation, when Balaam and the donkey are the story, the word is applied to the very angel of the Lord, to God himself. And so it's really just a description, just a category. It's like the prosecutor. The Satan was also among them. Now, this is unusual too when you think about it, because after the events of the Garden of Eden, would God have had Satan around? And he said he would crawl on the face of the earth. But clearly, God found it to God's advantage to have Satan be in his presence at certain points. And so here he is. God says, "Where have you come from?" And he says, "From going to and fro on the earth." Then God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And this starts the whole story. in process. It starts the wheels turning. There's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And Satan says, well, of course he is. You do everything for him and you give great riches. Take those away from him and he'll curse you to your face. And God says, very well, all that he has is in your power. Only do not stretch out your hand against him personally. So HaSatan, the Satan, went out from the presence of the Lord, and he proceeds to take everything that Job has away. The sons and daughters were out drinking, and a messenger came in and said, the oxen and the donkeys are gone, and all the servants are killed. And then we find out that the other animals have also been killed, and the other taken, and the other servants have been killed. And then worst of all, in verse 18, we find out that his sons and daughters were all together, and that's why that's significant. And they were all killed at once by a great wind that made the house fall on them. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshiped. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing. If the story ended there, and it could end there, if the principal actors in the story didn't make it continue, if the story had ended there, God could turn to Satan at that point and say, I won. Job maintains his righteousness, and he did not curse me or charge me with wrongdoing. And the story could have ended there if God wanted to, but he had other things in mind. And so we see a repeat in chapter 2 of pretty much the same story, where God says, how'd it work out with Job? He's an upright man who turns away from evil, and he persists in his integrity, even though you've taken everything away from it. And Satan says, well, yes, people will do that, but try to take his life from him and see what he does. And God says, well, very well, he's in your power. The thing is, you can't kill him. You can do anything you want to him physically, but you can't kill him. I have a reason for keeping him alive. So he went out and inflicted horrible curses on Job, to the point where Job had to scrape himself, and he sat in a garbage heap, basically, because he was an oozing horrible thing. He didn't want to be a problem. I mean, he went out there where it was the easiest to take care of himself. In verse 9, his wife says, do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die. And, you know, we're very hard on Job's wife. I've heard sermons over the years where we tell about what a horrible person she was and why didn't Satan take away the wife since she was tormenting Job. But I think we need to cut her a lot of room because she had just lost 10 children. She had probably lost many friends. She had lost her security and the possessions that she and her husband had worked to build. Everything was taken away from her, even though we talk about Job being punished, but she was also suffering from it. And it's in our minds sometimes that Job says, you're a foolish woman, but he never says that. What he says is, you speak like a foolish woman would speak. He's actually being kind and tender to her, considering the circumstances. He doesn't say, you're speaking foolishly. He says, you're quite a woman, but you're speaking the way that foolish women speak. And he says, so we receive the bad from God and not the good from God and not the bad. And in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Then three friends of Job show up. And may I say, they do it right. They do what friends ought to do at this point. They come from afar to visit him to his home. They met together beforehand and they went and decided that they were going to console and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they didn't even know who he was. And they wept and they went and they sat with him and they raised their voices. And they sat with him for 7 whole days, just being there. You know, we should be that kind of friends. We should be there for people when they need it. The friends did it right at that time. And then people start talking. And they talk and they talk and they talk. And it goes on for chapters and chapters and chapters. And in verse 3, Job starts out and it's totally understandable. What he says is right. He's cursing the day that he was born. After 7 days of suffering, he has a right to do this. He's lamenting what's happened to him. And then his friends speak, and they go back and forth with Job arguing him about, is God just and is Job a sinner? But they actually start out right. They actually start out right by just saying that, that God is just and that reward and punishment comes from God. And Job was punished, and their conclusion is that Job must have sinned. It actually gets worse than that as it goes on. His so-called friend Bildad even says that his children brought their deaths upon themselves. And that's what you want to hear at that point, isn't it? When blamelessly your 10 children have died and have been taken away. And Bildad says, well, they deserved it. And he comes right out and says that in chapter 8. And in Zophar says in chapter 11 that Job deserves even more than he got. That if God were just, he would take more away. So this part is a mess, both what the friends say and what Job says. And it's what you would expect. It's an emotional roller coaster. Sometimes they're near the truth. Sometimes they're far from the truth. Sometimes they just seem to be ranting. And kind of like me saying, I'm real, that to me lends some authenticity to the tale, because it's not a carefully thought out thing. They're speaking from their hearts. And they're saying things that sometimes really don't make sense. Sometimes they go down a path that's almost what God says in the end. For instance, Zophar starts down a right trail. And he says, well, let's look at it, if my fingers will work. He says, in verse 7 of chapter 11, Zophar says, can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? Is it higher than heaven? What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, can you know? And this echoes God's words at the end. I'm not giving you a spoiler because you've read the book and you know how it ends. And so for some of the time that they're right. And Job echoes him in chapter 26. Job takes the same path. And again, Job's emotions and reasoning are all over the place. But in chapter 26, he talks about God's great works and the wonders of God and how the pillars of heaven and the face of the waters and the boundary between light and darkness. And he struck down Rahab, who is the proud being. We think that's another name for this being who's now the prosecutor. So sometimes they get close to God's truth. This, incidentally, is the section where God says a very interesting thing in chapter 19. And we need to keep this in mind. In chapter 19, very famous verses that have been put by music, and you've heard them done for special music. Job says in chapter 19, in verse 25, he says, I know that my Redeemer lives. And in my Bible, it's capitalized. He's talking about a spirit being. And that at last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then in the flesh shall I see God. So Job fully expects to die and to be resurrected. And you can read a little more about that. But what this means is that God, in his friendship with Job, in his great friendship with Job, Job has learned quite a bit about God's plan. But the rest of the world doesn't know. And this is a really early reference, you know, to people dying and then being resurrected and being redeemed. It's quite amazing that Job says that. And yet, eventually, Job doesn't have the understanding that God wishes that he had. There comes a point when Job can't stand it anymore, and he tells his friends that they're worthless and they're troublesome and they're horrible. And he makes his final arguments. He maintains his integrity the entire time, rightfully so. And he starts pleading with God to talk with him face to face. Job admits that the wicked, he argues that the wicked often go unpunished, that there are wicked people who make millions and billions of dollars and go up into space and own islands in Hawaii and do all kinds of things. And they're not particularly righteous people. And yet, you know, they're some of the most blessed people in the world. In chapter 27, Job talks about the fact that he holds fast his righteousness. In verse 6, he said, I hold fast my righteousness and I will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. He says at that point that he is innocent. And Job calls on the heavens to testify on his behalf. And there's a beautiful interlude then in the next chapter in chapter 28, where, you know, this is poetry. This is one of the reasons we read Job, is for the beautiful archaic poetry, the fairy tale language, because it's written in very ancient language. Supposedly it has Aramaic overtones to it. I don't know, because I read it in English, but the language is old, just like our old tales would be. And in chapter 28, he talks about wisdom. And in verse 12, he says, where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Mortals do not know the way to it. It's not found in the land of the living. And you can read that yourself, the beautiful things that he goes to. But he ends up by saying in verse 28, and this is a verse that we can take out of context and keep in our hearts. He says in verse 28, after considering this, God said to humankind, truly the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So even at this point, Job may not be understanding what's going on, but he's still committing himself to departing from evil, and that wisdom has to do with being righteous. And of course, by the time he gets to chapter 31, which is the next to the last time that Job speaks, he's saying, let the Almighty answer me. He's saying, I don't know where to find God, but I need to find God. We need to speak. He needs to accuse me. I need to tell him that I'm innocent. He needs to judge me. We need this to happen. Because Job and his friends think that the world is run by justice. They know that God is just, and they think that that's how the world is run. And Job cannot understand why things have happened. Well, then at that point, a person shows up, and we don't know much about him. His name is Elihu. We know that he's younger than Job and his friends, and we know that he's mad. He seems to be a friend of God himself. He seems to be on God's side and know what's going on. But his language is very different from the others. So it's thought that maybe he comes from a different part. He says that Job is wrong. Not only is Job wrong, but his friends are more wrong. And he extols God, and he talks about the great things that God does. And in the last chapter of his speech, which is chapter 37, the man goes on for six chapters at this point. But in chapter 37, he talks about God speaking out of the storm. And we realize that there's a storm approaching at this point, that the reason he spends all this time doing it is because this huge storm is coming up. And it turns out that it's God himself coming in with wind and clouds and smoke, which is what happens when God comes to the earth. And starting in verse 38, God answers Job out of a whirlwind, out of a tornado, out of an immense windstorm. God's explanation at this point is that humans cannot hope to understand his actions. He says, you know, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. In chapter 40, Job has a chance to speak. God pauses long enough, and Job is overwhelmed at this point. He's starting to get it. And he says, see, I am small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once, but I'm not going to speak again. I want to hear what you have to say. And he's starting to be impressed by God's argument. And God goes on and he talks about, he encourages Job. By the way, in this section, God is quite sarcastic to Job. He treats Job as an old friend, someone he's dealt with. God, he's actually sarcastic. You know, tell me if you know. Maybe you're so good that you can do this. And my first thought when I see this is, I've been godly all this time and I never even knew it. Because you might not be aware of this, but I have a tendency to be sarcastic from time to time. And it's nice to know that possibly that will survive into the kingdom in a good form. But God, at this point, his final argument is these two beasts that he have made. And they're unusual choices. The first in chapter 40 is called Behemoth. And the second is called Leviathan. And they might be beasts that were living at that time, and they might not. But he knew that Job knew about these beasts, because Leviathan appears in the story of God prior to that point. And Behemoth, if you read the description, some people say, well, it sounds like a hippopotamus. But if you read the description, what it sounds like is a brontosaurus, which is really weird, because We've never seen a live brontosaurus, and I don't think Job did. I don't think they were around at that time. But he not only expected Job to know about it, but he expected Job to be so impressed by him that it was the end of his argument, that God was quite proud of that part of his creation. Well, Job repents. He's humbled. He apologizes. God says that his friends were wrong, but Job was right, which is the shocking thing to say at that point. Because Job wasn't right about a lot of the things he said. He was right, but he wasn't right in demanding that God answer him. And he has Job make sacrifices for the friends, because otherwise evil would befall them, he says. And Job isn't in a sacrificing mood at that point, but he does it, and he prays on their behalf. And God does not, the phrase is, he doesn't deal with them according to their folly. He restores Job's fortunes from verse 10 on, and Job lives another 140 years in wealth and happiness. Simple story, right? Why do good people suffer? No, it's never answered. That question is never answered. It's not answered by Job. It's not answered by his friends. It's not answered by Elihu. And it's not answered by God. God ducks the question, actually, and just says, you don't have the perspective to judge me in that way. And then when you can do the things I can do, we can talk about it. So let's go back to the beginning and let's look at some things that maybe point in another direction. I mean, yes, why do good people suffer? But there's more. The first chapters, again, I will say it again, Job did not know about the court in heaven. It's possible that he never knew about it for his whole life. And it's possible that his friends never heard about it. It's possible that Elihu didn't know about it. And God doesn't bring the subject up. And so, from that point of view, if this was a whodunit, and they're trying to figure out who the guilty person party is and why things happened the way that they did. If Agatha Christie had written this story, nobody ever figures it out, and the story is a bust. Elihu, in a way, allows for it, because in some of his words, he says that, sometimes suffering is used so God can build people's character and that they can come along. Sometimes suffering is allowed for things to happen in the future. But since no one names the true villain all the way to the end, then all their arguments, in one sense, are pointless. Job's suffering was not punishment. I mean, God wasn't directly punishing him. What he was doing was allowing it to happen. If God or someone was really trying to punish Job, he would have killed him. Job brings this up a number of times. He says, "Why am I even alive? Why don't you take my life? What's the point in doing all this? Why was I supposedly so good, and you blessed me in so many ways, and you take it away, and now you won't even let me die?" He wants to die in certain ways. He said, "I wish I'd never been born." And yet, it's very important to God that Job live. The accuser's question in chapter one is worth looking at, because what the Satan says is, he says, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hand, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." So the Satan is not talking at this point about why do good people suffer. What he's asking is, why do good people get rewarded? What's the point of that? And he does say, if you take it all away, well, then he won't have anything. God's quite confident that that's not true. So that casts things in a somewhat different light and gives us somewhat to think, something to think about. But let's back up one sentence from there. And let's look at what God says before that. The heavenly beings are before God. They're called the sons of God, by the way, which is interesting terminology. And it's got to be in heaven, or someplace where human beings can't see it or sense it at any rate. And the Lord said to the Satan, "Where have you come from?" Now, he knew the answer to that, but he wanted Satan to say, "Well, I've been watching what happens on the earth. I've been roaming the earth and looking at what's happening." And then God says, very deliberately, he says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" It's God who starts this in motion. God didn't have to say that at all. God had a reason for doing it. And, you know, he was pushing Satan's button. Frankly, after that, you know, the Satan may think he had free will and a choice in saying what he said, but he said exactly what God expected him to do by pushing that button. He said, "Have you noticed, Job?" And the immediate answer is, "Well, take it away from him and see what it's like." And God says, "Okay." So you could blame God for the whole thing, for the wheels starting to turn at that point. God decided that he would do it at that point. But let's go back one more level and let's think about what led up to God wanting to ask that question. Because apparently God was holding it in wait for a time when it would be appropriate, for a time that it could work out, that it was part of his plan, and that there was a reason for doing it. Maybe God had something on his to-do list at this point, something that had to happen for his plan to proceed, and he was waiting for the right person and time to come along to set it in motion. God dealt at that point and now in friends, intense, joyful relationships that bring God as much happiness as it does the humans. He started out with Adam. There's reason to think that Abel would have been one of those friends. We know that Enoch was, that God walked with him for years and years. We know that Noah was a joyful friend of God, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they celebrated their times together. That Moses was someone he could talk to, and others down the line, others that we don't even know about. He was a long time between these friends sometimes, and that's why they get so emphasized. They meant more to him than we suppose, just as his friendships do today. Eliphaz in chapter 4 says something very strange, and it's a story that we read. He says in chapter 4 and verse 12, "Now a word came stealing to me. My ear received the whisper of it amid thoughts from the visions of the night when deep sleep falls on mortals. Dread came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face. The hair of my flesh bristled. It stood still." He's being visited by a spirit being at this point. You know, it reminds me of last Sunday night. I was lying in bed, and about 1:30, my eyes opened, and I saw lights climbing the walls and swirling around on the ceiling. And I was, for a few seconds, I was terrified. And then I realized what was going on, and I put on my clothes, and I went outside, and I readjusted my neighbor's Halloween projector that was supposed to be projecting these things on his garage, but instead was projecting them into my bedroom. Well, that was fake, but in Eliphaz's case, it was real. And in verse 17, the question is asked, not by Eliphaz and not by God. Can mortals be righteous before God? Can human beings be pure before their maker? Even in his servants, he puts no trust, and in his angels, he charges with error. And this is his big beef. This is HaSatan's big beef with God. And Satan is the one who's bringing it up and injecting it into this argument. It gets repeated by Bildad in chapter 5 and in Eliphaz in chapter 22. And it's the most dangerous thing to me in the entire story. Because in chapter 22, let's look at Eliphaz's words there. Eliphaz the Temanite answered, he's answering Job at this point. He says, "Can a mortal be of use to God? Can even the wisest be of servant to him? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous, or is it gain to him if you make your ways blameless?" And this is the evil in this story, because the answer is mortals can be of use to God. And the only reason we know that is because God says so. I mean, why is God doing everything that he's doing? It's because he wants to be around mortals. And yes, they are of use to him. And yes, he takes delight. What's coming out in these friends is what Satan's group of people have been saying since before Adam was even created. Can a mortal be righteous before God? And in that first instance, the true feelings come out. He says, we even know that spirit beings aren't trusted by God. Well, spirit beings are trusted by God. Eliphaz is wrong here, and it's the most grievous wrong in the entire story, as far as I'm concerned. Behind the story, underneath all the words that fly to and fro in this book, God pulls off an amazing, neat plan that benefits Job, that benefits God's friendship with Job and that benefits God's plan all the way down the line through history, and that benefits every child of God from that time on, including us today. God had a relationship with Job. He'd even showed him his plan. But Job was stuck somehow. Job's righteousness may have started out to serve God. I mean, maybe he started with nothing. Maybe he turned to God and pursued God. And God blessed him at that point and gave him those thousands of animals and 10 children and great wealth and the ability to do anything he could and the esteem of his fellow men and women. And people, you know, waited to hear upon his word, he says. But that was all built up through Job's friendship with God. But somehow Job became stuck and the righteousness became the thing. It became a rote thing for him, apparently, where it was so important to him, where he said, I maintain my righteousness. And we can see a little bit of that before God even talks about it in what he did with his children, in that his children got together and partied, and they may have committed wrong, they may have committed sins. And Job does sacrifices on their behalf just in case, because he likes to dot I's and cross T's, and he likes to take care of things. And he's more concerned at this point with the format of righteousness than he seems to be neglecting his friendly relationship with God at that point. It becomes a very, you know, OCD thing for him, it seems like. Job's righteousness started out to serve God, but at this point, it seems like he's being righteous for righteousness' sake. This is my interpretation, and the accuser has a point. And he starts out in his own arguments quite correct. But in chapter 13, things start to take a turn. He starts saying, I need to speak to the Almighty and I need to argue my case with God. He probably doesn't say it that emphatically because he's terribly ill and he's scraping himself. And, you know, he doesn't have much strength at that point. But he says, only grant two things to me. Withdraw your hand or call on me and I will answer. By the time we get to chapter 27 and chapter 31, Job's attitude towards God is calcified into his own focus on his righteousness. And don't get me wrong, he was righteous. God never questions that. James never questions that. Ezekiel never questions that. It's never questioned in the rest of the story. But he was sorely in danger of committing the wrong that Moses committed when he struck the rock to get water out of Meribah. And that's that he was starting to think that it was him, that the righteousness was him. God loved Job, but he missed the happiness and the wonder of the original friendship. Job was a good servant, but God wanted more than a good servant. And God decided to find a way to, in video game parlance, level him up, to bring him up to a new level. So what do we see in chapter 1 and chapter 2? He says, very well, this man is in your power. Only spare his life. He has to live because I have more things in store for him. And then God comes and speaks to him. Can you imagine? This story has universal application. But in our case, God is not going to come and speak to us. If he does, text me any time of day or night. I'm interested. But God does come and speak to Job, just as Job has asked. Does he give him answers? No. He nearly blows Job out of the way with wonder at what God has created and to see how magnificent and wonderful God and his creation are. He treats Job rather roughly, like you would treat a close acquaintance. As I said, he uses sarcasm and he floods Job with examples of his creation. In chapter 40, he gives Job a chance to speak and he's already changing. He's already moving back to where God wants him to be. And he says, no, I've spoken enough. Keep going. And so he talks about Behemoth and Leviathan and uses them as his greatest proofs. We could talk about those two things for a long time. Job had said, I demand an explanation. And God's reply is, my explanation is, I invite you to trust in my wisdom and my power and my glory. Job responds. We look at the tone of the last chapter. It's so beautiful. In verse 10, God restores the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. And we don't know, you know, if instantly 10,000, what is it? If 14,000 sheep just appeared in the field, I rather think not. I rather think that Job and his wife, together as a team, rebuilt, that God gave them the beginnings of how to do it. And that's what we see in verse 11. His brothers and sisters who haven't been mentioned before, but it seems like there's quite a few of them, and all who had known him before. So he was still thought well of. And they came and they ate bread with him in his house. We like to think they brought the food with them. I mean, can you imagine going and eating Job out of house and home at that point? But they showed him sympathy and they comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And there it is. The Lord had let the evil be brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a gold ring. The Lord blessed the latter days, and he had twice as many animals as he had before, and he had seven sons and three daughters. And one of the clues that Job is back to being a friend, a fun person. We don't think of Job as a person who would be much fun at parties. We probably wouldn't invite him because Job would sit around and go, oh, but he wasn't that way at all. He was only that way for a short time of his life. The rest of the time, he was a vibrant, living, joyful friend of God, a brilliant person. And he names his daughters, he and his wife, he names them Jemima, Keziah, and Karen Hapuch, which are, they have their own meanings. But what he really named them was these three daughters, beautiful, beautiful people. He named them Dove, Cinnamon, and Dark Eyes. That's what those names mean. Dove, Cinnamon, and Dark Eyes. That has sort of a trailer park ring to it. I mean, those are very strange, emotional, beautiful names to give people. It's not the name that you would want them to have on their business card when they become a lawyer later on. No, they're beautiful, rejoicing names, rejoicing in all that God has given them. In the land, there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and he treats them differently now. He gives them an inheritance. They don't have to go to their brother's house. He realizes that all this, everything that God has given to him is special and worth rejoicing in. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and his children's children four generations. And Job died old and full of days. And at this point, we still don't know if he knows what really happened. So all is well. And you think, well, that's the end. But no, there's more, because the story applies to us today. This has been a harrowing few months for us. Just reading our bulletin, look at what happened with the feast this year. Last year, it seemed like we had quite a bit of protection. But this year, many of us came home. I mean, my own calculations for all different groups, not just for our own United Church of God, is that there are more than 1,000 people that I can document who came home ill. And we look at what happened. So many of us got sick. I got sick. I was very, confident in my way of dealing with this plague. But no, I got sick. And so did many of you. And people died. But we look at what happened. And we don't doubt that God is still the wonderful creator and a father with a plan that he has always been. But still, he let some terrible and sobering things happen. He didn't make them, but he let them happen. And people have been sick. People have died. People are still dying. While we were arguing about how we should approach this plague, God, who has pretty much protected us up to this point, has let things happen, at which point, my friends, our arguments become pretty stupid. And we look to the book of Job in times like this, for whatever reason, and we see that God has an end in mind. He had it for Job, and he has it for us, and he fully intends to bring us to that point. We might die first, but he'll still bring us to that point. But the ones of us who are still very much... We learn from the story of Job that there's a purpose to trials, and that we are to meet these trials with humility and a newfound determination to do what's written in Hebrews 12:1, which is to throw off every weight that's holding us back and to move forward. We need to have an open mind about who God is, which Job didn't have. But then he did. His mind did open up and he accepted God for the way he was. And we have to stop thinking that we know everything that God wants. And we have to see how God operates and see what he's doing. And we need to continue to learn how he works and not be determined to have him operate according to our rules. We need not just to be righteous, but to be God's children and rejoice in his creation and his majesty and his goodness and his plans, not ours, and to come back to him in any way that we are falling short. There's actually a lot to be done before Jesus Christ ever returns, and he still needs committed friends, not just obedient people, but creative, energetic friends to do it. Let's not let these trials that God has given us be in vain. And he does it for the same reason that he did it to and for Job, to bring children into his family and friendship now, and eventually to bring many sons to glory, as the author of Hebrews says. And his unstoppable desire to do so proves that mere mortals are of use to him, in spite of what the powers of evil say. And he is willing to trust them. And the journey of Job blows out of the water the concept that people are of no use to God. We don't have to learn that the hard way, as Job did. We can start with that because we have Job's example. God let it happen at that point of history, and it doesn't have to happen again. We can learn from it. Job was strong enough and had enough perseverance that God could set things in motion at that point and know that Job would come out all right with his help. And we owe both God and Job a debt of gratitude. God and Job. God oversees our trials. And the accuser can still say, well, let me at him, let me at her. Let's see what this person is made of. And Jesus said that that very question came up in the case of Peter. There may have been a court in heaven, just like as in the book of Job, where Satan says, let me have Peter. And what Jesus says is that he would guarantee the outcome. He didn't say he would keep Peter from that. And this was right before Peter denied him and went through, you know, before the crucifixion. And he said that Peter would be sifted, but that his faith would not fail. He could count on that. And Peter would come through it strengthened enough to help all his brothers and sisters. And so it would work out to be for the benefit of God. Immediately afterward, Jesus Christ sacrificed his own life on Peter's behalf, just as he did for us. And if the accuser says, can a mortal be of any use to God? And God can turn to the accuser and say, God can turn at that point to the accuser or any power of evil and say, we actually hashed that out a long time ago. We don't need to do things on that basis ever again. And so we can turn to the book of Job and take a shortcut and just turn to, we don't have to go through that. We can learn from that experience and turn to God. This plague is terrible, but it will pass. I don't know how, I don't know when, but it will pass. It may pass on to worse things, and we'll wish we were back in the days when it was only a plague. But let's take this challenge and move forward into God's work and family now and his kingdom in the future. And in times like these, we can turn to the book of Job to inspire us and to fill us with Job's determination, the endurance that James said he had, and to gladden our hearts and to help light our path.